If you're feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois, a fun, friendly, charming destination with boutique shops, small-town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer, and all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Log on to visitottawail.com today.
Today is Wednesday. It's January 22nd, 2025. It's 2:37 in the afternoon. And hi, this is John Williams. You found the Mincing Rascals podcast. Share us with your friends, please. We're the podcast for people who care about Chicago. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Ironlight, a marketing agency working to change the world.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now doing the Chicago History website. Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
And I'm Eric Zorn, former Tribune columnist, now the proprietor of the Picayune Sentinel, a Substack newsletter.
Since we last spoke, Donald Trump became the 47th president and gave his inaugural address. It was a really weird speech. Conservative columnist George Will said it was the worst ever, worse than his Carnage speech 8 years ago. It included his assertions that we'll plant a flag on Mars and rename the Gulf of Mexico. Since we last spoke, he has signed scores of executive orders, too. He launched a challenge to the 14th Amendment and had to endure a nasty lecture by Bishop Marianne Buddy. At a service 2 days ago, she asked him to show compassion and mercy to migrants and LGBTQ plus people who are afraid, said Trump the bishop was nasty in tone, not compelling or smart, ungracious and boring, and she owes America an apology. In fact, Michael Collins of Georgia said that she should be deported to where I'm not sure, maybe her native New Jersey. Most upsetting to me this week were the pardons, though, both Joe Biden's and Donald Trump's. Austin, you weren't with us last week, but in the last week, what jumped out at you in that sort of menu of little news blurbs?
First of all, it's fast and furious, right? So there's a lot going on. This is a marked departure, I think, from his first term in terms of how many things are coming off the blocks and how quickly.
Yeah.
I think on the front, I'll start with birthright citizenship. That was the most important and what jumped out to me the most out of anything that was said. Because I think birthright citizenship is one of the greatest strengths of our country. It's one of the greatest gifts to mankind ever devised. And it's a very rare and very special thing in the world today and in world history. And I think what Trump signed, that executive order, is plainly illegal. And if you say you care about the Constitution, you cannot defend it. In part because it doesn't just include, or doesn't just exclude, I should say, babies born to illegal immigrants. It also excludes those born to people on legal temporary visas.
His proposal, yeah.
His executive order. And the debate over the 14th Amendment comes down to really the bit that says a kid is a citizen if they're born to someone, quote, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And there's just no serious legal argument that people here on lawful visas are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And so if you're, you know, a kid who was born to a parent on an H-1B visa, which allows people to come to the U.S. And work and make a life for themselves, these people aren't just passing through. And this order is crazy, and it would legitimately cause chaos for that reason. Yeah. And that's excluding, you know, illegal immigrants. So birthright citizenship, I think, to me, and I would recommend highly, I thought an article that did a good job of reviewing Supreme Court case law as well as congressional laws on birthright citizenship was actually from National Review. It's called Can Birthright Citizenship Be Repealed by Executive Order? I thought that was a really good overview.
Was that recent issue of the
recent? That's online.
The argument for birthright citizenship is that you don't want to create a nation of perpetual outsiders, that you don't want to have people who are here for generations yet do not have the privileges and responsibilities of citizenship. And this happens in other countries where they don't have it. There are 34 countries in the U.S. and in the world that have birthright citizenship. Most of them are smaller countries, but it is, I agree with
including Austin. Canada and Mexico.
Right, but it's a vehicle to to bring people into your culture. It's and it started. It's part of the 14th Amendment, and it came about because we had a problem. The country had a problem that you had enslaved people brought over here who then were enslaved, and then their children were enslaved, but they weren't citizens. And ultimately, we decided, well, how are we going to decide who was born where? And they said they're just going to do this. And the requirement that the person not be subjected to the jurisdiction of the United States is meant basically to deal with the problem of diplomats who are here. That if you are a diplomat in the U.S., you are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. You can't even get a parking ticket if you're a diplomat. So if you were subject to the laws, the jurisdiction of the country, which everybody who's here except diplomats is. And so it's very clear, and I'll be interested to read up. I'll put a link in the Picayune Sentinel to this National Review article, because I don't think there's a serious legal argument that says that someone who is here as a tourist or who is here legally or illegally is not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States.
Right, and what, Eric, to be clear, my interpretation of what does that mean, subject to the jurisdiction, it means that if you break a law, you will be punished for it. You're responsible for that. If you're speeding, if you kill somebody, if you rob a bank, you are subject to the laws, to the jurisdiction of the United States. Your citizenship doesn't give you a pass unless you're an invading army, maybe on a Native American tribe, or certainly the child of a diplomat. But that's not who we're talking about here. They are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. That's what that's for, right?
I think you're right, John, and I think almost everybody has agreed that that's true in the courts, et cetera. The Supreme Court affirmed this all the way back in 1898. They reaffirmed it in like 1982. I get the argument that there is some outside chance that with the current conservative Supreme Court that we shouldn't count on them, you know, going by precedent, but you know, all the legal opinions pretty much seem to point to this is a non-starter. So it to me, this looks like something that, of course, sounded good to Donald Trump. I mean, he campaigned on this last time, too, right? His anti-immigration is a big thing for him. But I think it's just one of those things that he has thrown out there to get everybody chasing as many balls as possible.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that the various state attorney generals are suing for an injunction, and it will go through the courts, and hopefully the Supreme Court will bat it down. But I do think it's kind of
well, let me ask you this, Kate.
A distraction. I think it's a distraction because it's not going to happen.
Right.
And the one thing I would say is that I think Democrats are falling into an old trap. Not everybody, but I see, you know, quite a few people arguing for birthright citizenship, but in a way that their point is that everybody should not even be talking about it, that it's like a moral issue that cannot be discussed. And I do think that while I agree, I want birthright citizenship, I especially agree with what you pointed out, Eric, the argument that it would create a big sub-underclass of people. We don't want that here. That's one of the great things about our country, that we don't have that. But I think it's important to allow an open discussion. It's
but it'll be an academic exercise then, because there's just...
I do think so,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, but to that point then, what if we started all over again? I mean, what is the logic of where you're born determines your citizenship status? Maybe it should be it's the citizenship status of your parents and not the geography of your birth.
Maybe it's good to have that discussion, because, I mean, the reason this is really a thing is because of the way President Biden especially did let immigration over the southern border get pretty out of control. We're up to at least 12 million undocumented or illegal immigrants, depending on how you want to phrase it, in the country, which is at least at the highest level from like 2007, I think I saw. But they think it could have gone up to as much as 13 or 14 million at this point. So we like literally have the largest foreign-born population between legal and illegal immigrants. And that's not great for social cohesion. And people do have a right to be concerned about it and think that it shouldn't be quite that big. I think it's important for Republicans to admit that getting rid of it would create an underclass and create all kinds of social problems. But Democrats should also admit that it is a motivation. It is a draw for people to come here in order to have children who will be citizens.
There are some estimates that you'll have up to 20,000 births a year in the U.S. that are just tourist babies, that there are people who come from other countries when they are 8.5 months pregnant just to give birth in the U.S., just so their kids can have citizenship here. And I don't know how you would write a law that would prevent that unless you were to stop pregnant people at the border. And so you think, well, what is really the downside of a child from China, say, being born here and having dual citizenship? Is there really a downside to that? Do we need more people in this country, we really do. And I understand what Kate's saying about the need for border security. I think there ought to be better border security. I think you're right. The Biden administration didn't take that issue seriously enough. And they tried, too late. They tried with that bill that the Republicans killed because they'd rather run on the issue than run on.
They waited 3 years to do anything, though.
They waited too long. I mean, I think Joe Biden, history is going to be fairly kind to Joe Biden, but it's especially things that he's done right here at the very end are pretty weird. And, weird is maybe the nicest word for some of it.
Yeah.
I take your point. I also do wonder, is this just a distraction? Is this the ball we're chasing down the street while these immigration raids are going to take place?
Yeah.
While he redraws all the maps and puts Mount McKinley back.
Mount McKinley. I forgot that McKinley, McKinley, Denali, McKinley. That to me is a thing that doesn't merit our attention. Austin, are you interested in the notion that if we were to start all over, would we include birthright citizenship? Is that inherently a good or logical thing?
I will say I don't think that this is a distraction. I would describe Gulf of America and Mount McKinley as distractions. And to some extent, the Mars, whatever, mission to Mars, like I think those things are more distractions. This is something that is part of the family history of so much of our country, including the vice president and the president. The vice president's wife is a U.S. citizen, was a U.S. citizen before she was married to J.D. Vance because of birthright citizenship. Trump's father, Fred, was a citizen because of birthright citizenship. His father came from Germany. And I think to the extent it is a distraction, I actually think it's something like distractions can actually be really harmful depending on what you're putting attention toward. And I think there's a really insidious and dangerous game being played right now on the right when it comes to immigration. And I agree with Kate, they have all this room to maneuver because there has been such horrible failure on immigration policy for so long. I don't think that excuses the behavior at all. I do think it helps explain what they think of as a wide latitude to do whatever the hell they want on this issue. But what's interesting is, and I've talked about this before on the show, Donald Trump will talk about big game about anti-DEI, anti-affirmative action, but he plays a kind of identity politics that's very powerful, and it's a nativist identity politics. And that nativist identity politics, I think, is actually at odds with a lot of Americans. And when you look at the polling data on this, it's really, really interesting. So you will see, CNN just put this poll up recently. ABC News over the last, every 2 years has polled Americans on, do you support deporting all illegal immigrants? And for the first time in many years, it's more than half of Americans think you should deport all illegal immigrants. And I don't think I need to describe to listeners of the show, like, the apparatus you would need to do that is extremely scary and totalitarian. To even to say if that were to happen, like, it would just be insane. But if you ask people specifically about different immigration policies, that picture becomes much, much different. So Data for Progress did some really cool polling, and it asked, do you support deportation for a person brought to the United States as a child without legal status who has lived here for 20 years? 68% of likely voters say that person should not be deported. Only 19% of people think that person should be deported. So that's on one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, you have Should a person who recently crossed the border without legal status, or actually, here's even a better one. Should a person who crossed the border without legal status and has a criminal record for a nonviolent offense be deported? That is 18% of people think that person should not be deported, and 67% of people think that person should be deported.
A nonviolent offense. So
a nonviolent offense.
So
and that is very broad and sweeping. And I think that this kind of rhetoric around birthright citizenship, one, it fuels that kind of thinking. Like, we're not going to be about securing the border. We're not going to be about, you know, removing people who are criminals from the country. We're going to be against the idea of someone coming to America from another place. And I think that's why this isn't just a distraction and why it's pretty dangerous.
Although in the case of birthright citizenship, I'll bet the House that even this Supreme Court, and I guess it'll get there, and maybe pretty quickly. This executive order, I think, is supposed to be enacted next month. But I bet the House that even this Supreme Court will say that, no, the 14th Amendment stands.
Yeah, I would hope so. But again, the reason for that is they'd have to not only overturn Supreme Court precedent, which I think this court could conceivably do that, but then there's also laws that have been passed by Congress that have kind of confirmed this definition. So it's a very high bar that Trump has to clear. It's not impossible. But I do hope, this is one of the beauties of the constitutional system, that the Constitution will work in this case.
So I get it. I think this is an interesting way for us to do podcasts for the next 4 years. Distraction, not worth our time, you know, or at least not worth our serious concern. You can have fun with it if you want. Greenland. Or something that really warrants serious concern, you know, march in the streets. I think the pardons were really unfortunate. I don't know how you fix that. I guess that's going to take a constitutional amendment, too. The president does have the power to pardon people. But I think Joe Biden's sins weren't as great as Donald Trump's. But I wish neither of them had pardoned anybody. Even Adam Kinzinger said, I don't want it. I don't need it. Don't pardon me. And he did preemptively as well as the January 6th committee and Mark Milley and Dr. Fauci and his brothers and sister and so forth. At least none of those people are convicted of having committed a crime, with the exception of his son. The 1,500 people that Donald Trump pardoned, many of them did, including the Proud Boys.
Well, here's what I'm going to float in my newsletter tomorrow, which is the idea that, you know, it's very difficult to amend the U.S. Constitution. It's been tried 12,000 times.
really?
And succeeded 27 times. And every year, about 37, on the average of 37, proposed constitutional amendments gets introduced in Congress, and we haven't had one since 1992. And the reason, of course, is that you need a really strong national consensus to change the Constitution. And that's probably for the better, because who knows how many amendments we'd have by now and what nutty things we would be required to do. But in this case, you've got both Republicans and Democrats who are furious about the way the pardon power was used for totally different reasons. But they see, the Republicans and some Democrats see, the way Joe Biden pardoned members of his family and did all these preemptive pardons as something that was not envisioned by the founders. That wasn't what the pardon power, the commutation power, was not there for that reason. And of course, on the other side, you've got Democrats and even some Republicans who are furious that Trump has pardoned people who went to the Capitol and beat up police officers. And he just said, oh, well, you're all, and not only he didn't just commute their sentences, he pardoned them. I mean, you did no wrong.
They're out.
And that's outrageous. And so you've got people on both sides, a lot of people on both sides, who think like something needs to be done to rein this in. And I'm not exactly sure how you would rein in the pardon power while still keeping it. But I think there are ways to require some legislative approval or so on. But this seems to me like an opportunity to amend the Constitution and to somehow limit the pardon powers in Article 2 and just restrict them somewhat so that you can't have presidents just going off and doing what Trump and Biden have done in the last week, basically.
That's a good point. I think this could be the time to do it, to actually get bipartisan support. As horrified as I am by both sets of pardons, yeah, maybe Biden did us a favor by doing his.
If it needed support in the Congress, this Congress would have also approved of the Donald Trump pardons. The Proud Boys would be out if it was a simple majority.
Maybe you would need to have some sort of a judicial review panel, bipartisan judicial review panel that would require votes from both sides in order to approve a pardon or commutations. I mean, it would add some layers of bureaucracy, but it would prevent things like what we're seeing this week. And again, I mean, I'm not completely outraged by Biden's pardons because I understand why he pardoned Fauci and Kinzinger and Liz Cheney and all those people that Republicans had threatened them.
Do you think that they committed crimes?
No, I don't think they committed crimes.
Well, do you believe in the justice system?
I do, except that I think that when you've got an out-of-control Congress or you've got an out-of-control Justice Department, they're hauling people in, making them hire lawyers. What are you going to prosecute Anthony Fauci for? Yeah, he got some things wrong. I don't think he did it. There's nothing he did that was criminal. Adam Kinzinger was doing his job. And members of that J6 committee were doing their job. And the idea that you're going to go after them criminally was just outrageous. And so I understand why Trump is doing that to protect himself. I get it. I understand why it makes Kate upset, but other people. But I understand it. But what side you're on this, I don't think there's anybody in the country who doesn't think that the pardon power was abused by one of these guys. And so that might give an opening to the kind of momentum that's needed to amend the Constitution.
Austin, do you have a fix?
Well, I think congressional approval for pardons on a case-by-case basis is a good idea because, John, maybe that gets a slim majority approval for the Jan 6th, but Trump has to then use political capital to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's a slim majority. And you're talking about on an individual basis, a person, you know, on tape beating up a police officer. I don't know if every Republican in Congress is like eager to take that vote, even if it's a pro-Trump vote. And even if they are, I mean, it's something that Trump has to twist their arm on that he can't on something else. So I think congressional approval is a good idea. I also think I'm really pessimistic on the idea that this will ever be reined in, but that's what makes it all the more outrageous, I think, in both cases, is because it's not going to be reined in. So really the only power we have to rein it in is like the precedent set by previous presidents. And in both cases, I think we're setting just completely new precedents.
It's carte blanche now.
Yeah, I thought that was an extraordinary overstepping of the authority. It's a pardon is a reprieve for a specific action. It's not a get out of jail free card for anything you might have done over any number of years that someone might find out about. And I totally think it was a gift to Trump and his enablers. And then in Trump's case, I mean, you had the vice president on television just completely lying and saying, well, no, we were not. It was never about pardoning violent rioters on January 6th. It's about, you know, the Justice Department overstepping their authority in this witch hunt. And then Trump was like, well, yeah, we'll see, and pardoned all of them. And I think in both cases, you have to, in the court of public opinion, make that a stain, just a horrible stain on their record. And I think in both cases that it's deserving of that. I think that's the only tool we have in the toolbox right now.
And that is why the Biden pardons outrage me maybe as much as the January 6th pardons. Maybe. I mean, I've got a lot of outrage to go around, so don't think I'm not outraged by the January 6th pardons. But that, you know, let's face it, we're not going to get an amendment on this. As much as all four of us want that, even if John was king, I don't know if we would get
I'd be a good king.
Amendment we would like on this. The absolute only thing reigning in was precedent. And Biden, who came into office claiming he was going to be the adult in the room, claiming that the Democrats were all about rule of law, is the one who opened the floodgates for it. And, you know, it doesn't matter if we think, oh, Trump would do whatever he wants anyway. The fact is, President Biden normalized it. And he did the last batch 20 minutes before he lost power, before the inauguration. 20 minutes. I mean, they didn't issue it until he was walking over for the ceremony. It's just like so craven. Last time around, he was asked on CNN by Jake Tapper, oh, do you think President Trump might give preemptive pardons to his kids? What do you think about that? And he said, oh, no, that would be terrible. That would be a terrible precedent. And it would look so horrible to other countries in terms of how we ourselves view our justice system.
One of the fixes that I proposed at one point was that there would be no presidential pardon authority between a presidential election and an inauguration, so that Biden, so that at least Biden's or any president's authority to do pardon people would end on election day, so that an election could in effect be referendum on, or maybe it'd have to be a couple, given early voting, maybe it has to be like a month before the election, that if you're going to do any pardons or commutations, do them then, so your party, your candidacy, your legacy is going to be affected by that thing, because these last minute part, this 20 minutes beforehand, that was not cool.
Speaking of Joe Biden, though, I thought it was nice to see at the inauguration ceremony how well behaved the Bidens were and the former presidents, first ladies and vice presidents were. There's a little bit of drama here. It wasn't exactly the Carter funeral, but it was a memorial service. But it was nice to see pretty much everyone there. And you can just imagine how difficult it was for Joe Biden and his wife and the vice president and her husband to do all of the ceremony, stand hand in hand, shake their hands, walk with them to the helicopter, you know, embrace a little bit.
I always think of those things about how George W. Bush was such a bad president, and yet he really shines in these like church-like moments where you're supposed to be very stern, and he's always goofing off. Like, I have family members who are like this, who cannot sit still in a church or anything for more than 2 seconds, and then he spitballs and stuff. And every time George W. Bush seems to be in a circumstance like that, he does something very meme-worthy, in complete contrast to his actual wielding of power as president.
He either breaks the ice or humanizes the moment a little bit, I'll say that.
You know, it was good to see that. I agree with you, John. I mean, especially since last time around, as you know, Trump did not attend Biden's inauguration.
Right. Yeah, good point.
And that was very troubling. Even with everything that had just gone on, that was troubling. So it did add a nice little sense of normality that we had for how many hours before the January 6th pardons?
In his inaugural address, which felt more like a State of the Union address, it was sort of top of the mind grievances and ideas about things we're going to do. It wasn't lofty like Kennedy's or Jefferson's or Reagan's, for that matter. It was more, hey, I'm still ticked off at these people, and by the way, they ruined the country. And it wasn't dark as the last one, but he pretty much just crapped on everybody that was standing there next to him, and even had them chuckling when he was bringing up silly stuff like planting a flag on Mars. We're not going to plant a flag on Mars. And if we do, that'll be all that lives there, is a flag. We are not going to colonize Mars. More of the Mincing Rascals, including our recommendations and non-recommendations at the end of this week's episode. If you are feeling a little cabin feverish, first let me tell you about a little winter road trip you might want to take, and that's to Ottawa, Illinois, a fun, friendly, charming destination with boutique stores, small-town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer, and all kinds of excellent casual fine dining. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms, hotels, private rentals, cottages, B&Bs. Start making memories in Ottawa. It's the middle of everywhere. Log on to visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Okay, our recommendations and other stuff at the end of this week's pod. Let's go back now to the Mincing Rascals. The migrants in Chicago have not been rounded up by ICE. That was supposed to happen on Tuesday. And maybe because the word was out that they were going to do these mass raids, they evidently had 2,000 as their target number.
And there's clearly a lot of fear out there. I guess places like Little Village, streets are empty and people are staying home out of fear. But I haven't heard of anything happening yet. But again, the threat is still out there, and the migrant community is feeling it pretty strongly.
And I think that's another reason why. So things like the birthright citizenship executive order, yeah, definitely it's signaling to the base. Definitely it's like maybe there's more bark than bite or something, but it matters a lot because it scares the crap out of people, people who have family members who are undocumented. And we are seeing that in Chicago right now. So I think that's another example, because that's, I've heard the same thing, Eric, in Little Village in Pilsen, where that's happening. I will say that that Wall Street Journal story that kind of kicked all of this off, I think it was a Friday, may have come out last Friday. Mm-hmm. And what was described in that article, when I talked to people who are experts in this locally, what's described in that article seems like actually kind of a routine operation of ICE in any big city, whether under Biden or Obama or Trump or Bush or whoever. And I think something we do have to be cautious of in this vein of like distractions is it's in Trump's interest to have news stories that people make to seem like he is being an extraordinary hardliner on this. And he's being like really tough on immigration. He's raiding Chicago first. And then there's also this news incentive to be the people who break that. And I think in that case, those two things came together and actually may not have helped immigrants. They may not have helped law enforcement. Like, I don't know if that would, that really, I thought that kind of more just played into Trump's interests, the way that that was reported.
Story I heard too is that more immigrants were deported in the Obama 4 years than they were in Trump's 4 years. I don't know what to make about that. Maybe that just speaks to how difficult this is to do, but well,
that speaks
more
to the media. That speaks to exactly the point, John. And that's something that blows people's minds. All that Obama deported more people than Trump, which is true. And that Joe Biden had the highest level of natural gas production of any president in history. and that just kind of breaks people's brains. And it's because of, you know, the way that media beats function, where it's like, well, Trump's the hardline immigration, so we're doing all stories on immigration. Obama's not really talking about immigration, but in the background, there's a lot of deportations. Doesn't get as much attention.
Well, and just in some fault land on the administration itself, if that were true, then Joe Biden should have made a better case for it. I think there's a lot of things that you could say he lost the election on that might have been things in his favor, but he didn't persuade people that the economy was better or that crime was down for the last 3 years, violent crime in America. That's all true. Why didn't people know that, or why didn't they care about that? That's a mess. Where's Marge when I need her? That sounds like a messaging issue to me.
Well, there's the fact that inflation did spike up to, what, 9.8%. It wasn't the highest in history, as Trump likes to say, but it did spike. And once inflation spikes, it really doesn't come back down again. And this is what Trump thinks, since he's going to lower prices. He says he's going to drill, baby, drill, and that's going to bring prices down. But, you know, when you're talking about creating new sources of energy acquisition, those take years to come online. So they're not going to bring gas.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
By the way, and we're already a net exporter of energy. So I'm not exactly sure what the urgent need for doing that is, and what the payoff is going to be. But yeah, you've got that situation going right now.
More locally, there's a new art display at the Chicago Cultural Center. I haven't seen it, but I've seen pictures of it. And I guess it shows, the pictures I've seen show two protest puppets, I guess we'll call them. One is of Benjamin Netanyahu, and the other puppet is an Uncle Sam puppet. They both have blood on their hands, right? The words "don't look away" are written on the Uncle Sam stand. Other words like the death toll in Gaza are either there or have been removed. Several city council members have fired off a letter to Mayor Brandon Johnson. This may be hate speech, they say. They want the boss of the cultural center called in on the carpet, and they want him to promise not to allow anything like this to ever happen again. They want him to, quote, outline steps that will be taken to prevent similar incidents in the future.
Both papers have gigantic pictures to go with the story. They are, you know, it is a very controversial, very in-your-face exhibit. There is no nuance involved here whatsoever.
Right. We have blood on our hands because we supported Israel. And where is the depiction of where's the Hamas puppet, I guess, would be, or the Palestinian puppet, one might ask. You know, I think it's kind of a losing proposition to argue the merit of art or the art of art. Art is, and you do or don't have to like it. You do or don't have to get it. I guess there would be exceptions to that.
This kind of culture war stuff, I really don't like. Like when people are the main my main criticism of the art is that it just sucks as art, and it's not even its political message. Like, it's just kind of, it's like, I remember Kate a couple of weeks ago, we were just like, the political cartoon in WAPO didn't run, and I was like, who cares? Not even that good of a cartoon. But I do think the valid point here is, if you're going to have something that has a, you know, strong political message in art, as much as many art pieces are highly political, would the reaction be the same if there was a piece of art with the opposite orientation? Would that be welcomed, or would there be protests telling, you know, the cultural center to take it down? And I think if you're a place that's engaging and funding that kind of art, you have to take a more broad, I think it's incumbent upon you to kind of both sides this stuff, or else you're going to end up in hot water like this, and, you know, people will think you're playing favorites. I would also say, I think this is completely irrelevant if it's a privately funded institution. And the reason that is, you know, being that is, this is coming out in the news is because this is a taxpayer funded thing. And that's why people are getting worked up about it, is that I disagree with this political message that my taxpayer money is going to fund.
I'm not seeing in either article whether this was the art exhibit itself was publicly funded, or just that it was approved and is being hosted by the cultural center, which obviously is a public institution.
Well, it couldn't have cost much to make. I'm looking at that thing and I'm thinking, I got all that stuff in my basement. I could have cranked that out tomorrow. Sorry, artists, if you're listening.
It's got the public element. And I'm a little surprised that the public, that the cultural affairs and public art department doesn't have some kind of guidelines for just how political they're going to fund either exhibitions or actual making of public art. That's a tough one. I mean, there's no doubt, just like you said, Austin, if it was in a private gallery, that would be that. The painting that was so objected to of Mayor Washington in lingerie at the Art Institute, that was a student art exhibit, and the alderman had absolutely no right to go marching over there and take it down whatsoever. It was not using public money, and it was none of their business. Ditto if it was in some other private art gallery. This is a little bit different, and it looks like we're going to be having a public discussion of what the guidelines are going to be going forward.
Yeah, which bothers me, because I don't think the city council should be the arbiters of what's good enough or interesting enough art to display, even in our tax-supported institutions. Lord knows they've got a lot on their plate.
Art can be a very powerful anti-war message. I'm thinking of like Picasso's Guernica, which was the 1937 painting objecting to the Nazis bombing of Guernica. And it was extremely moving imagery. I would agree with those who say that this piece of art seems like something that maybe protesters would have put together with, you know, paper mache in their at their protest camps on. And so it wasn't as a piece of art. It was almost more just a political statement.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I really don't like the idea of alders being art critics or trying to suppress speech, because that's essentially what this is. It's speech. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to create a forum, which is an art, public art display is a forum, then I don't want these alders going in and saying, well, that offends me, because it's saying something that a lot of people have been saying. I mean, you know, the merits of it notwithstanding, there are a lot of people who feel like that what the U.S. enabled Israel to do, and what Israel has done to Gaza, was awful. Now, that's part of the public debate. And if you want to try to balance that, if you're the curator and say, well, let's have something that deplores what Hamas has done, let's do that. But the idea of saying, like, we're going to take this down because it makes a statement that is otherwise permitted political speech, strikes me as an overreach and something the alder should not be dealing with.
Well, what would you have done if you were in charge of the Cultural Arts Center and they said, we want to put these two protest puppets up? Would it be as it is, Eric, or what would you have done?
Well, I would have probably tried to find something that would present the other point of view if I'm putting this thing together. Unless the piece making one point was a really great piece of art and the other one was a really crappy piece of art, I don't think that I would try to judge it on its artistic merits rather than its political merits. But I would try, knowing the sensitivities, I would try to balance it out. But I mean, it's a really difficult job, but that should be left up to the people who are curating the exhibit and not the alders.
It is publicly funded, so there have to be some sort of actual public guidelines.
That's the that's the part of this whole thing that bothered me the most. I don't like this city council coming up with guidelines for this kind of speech or art. I think that's...
And yet there have to be some guidelines. Who's coming up with them? And obviously we all have a right to comment on the guidelines, whatever they are. Are there any guidelines? It's hard to believe there aren't, but it doesn't really look like it.
It doesn't look like it.
I would guess there are some guidelines having to do with sexual content in art in public places like that, sponsored by the city. So, yeah, I mean, they're going to be restrictions. I would think that you would want those to be fairly loose, and you wouldn't want them to necessarily be political.
Well, they've had 36 years to come up with some. I mean, I'm looking at the Mirth and Girth Wikipedia page. Mirth and Girth is the name of the painting that a student at the Art Institute did in 1988, and it shows a Mayor Harold Washington dressed in women's undergarments with a cigar in his hand, and it's and that's it. He's got no other clothes on. It's kind of grotesque. I don't know if somebody thinks it's funny. I don't know what the message was or is here, but I could see why people would take offense to it. It seems to be kind of a non sequitur. It's like, what are you even talking about? What's the point of this?
Harold was dead. This came a year after his, or in the months after his death, anyway. And there were rumors that he had been, that the doctors at Northwestern who treated him had found him in women's underwear. I have no idea if that's true, and I hate to repeat them even all these years later, but that's what that was based on. And there were also rumors that Harold Washington was gay, which at the time would have been, horrifying. Who knew that we would have a gay mayor coming up after that? But it was widely seen as really an offensive insult to someone who had just died. And the painting was actually fairly amateurish, I thought, too. So it was I understood why people were mad about it. But again, with something like this, I think you just kind of say, well, that's somebody's statement and you ignore it. This art and this thing at the Cultural Center and that thing at the student exhibit and the Art Institute, it got so much more attention, so much more exposure than it otherwise would have because everyone got all upset about it. And I think you just go, well, that's art. The artist is making a point, and I don't agree with that point, but I'm not going to lose any sleep over it.
I see the point of the city council members who are citizens, Kate, marching over there in protest, even though it's these public officials exercising influence over a private institution, but it's a place that does exist with some public support, and they are a group of people that took offense to it. So I'm not surprised that they tried to exercise their, will about that sort of thing.
Public art is just so difficult. Just by me, we've got murals underneath the Illinois Central train tracks at 55th and 57th and 59th. And the 55th Street mural, I just despise. And I have to walk by it all the time. And everyone else loves it. It's a mural depicting the poem Under City Stone. Everyone thinks it's great. And I would never say, I would never try and go paint it over or anything. But I was very disappointed when they restored it. I was hoping when it got faded, it would go away after 30 years. Because it's just super depressing. The whole it's fabulous poetry, but it's all basically saying, wow, cities suck. Just being here in this city is just pulling the life out of you people and ruining everything, which to me is just not the message that I feel in my neighborhood.
We did a segment on our radio station for a while called Art or Crap. And then we would talk about something that's on display in the city, the cows, the 25-foot tall Marilyn Monroe. Is that kitschy crap or is that art? The Marilyn Monroe
cows
statue.
Cows are art. I love the cows.
Yeah. What about the Marilyn Monroe statue? I don't even know if that was ever supposed to be art, but boy, a lot of people got their pictures taken in front of it. Under her upblown skirt. Mary Schmeek wrote a really good column about that many years ago. You remember that, Eric?
Oh, yeah, I do. And I thought that was a fun sculpture. It was right outside of our window at the Tribune Tower.
I looked at it every day for a year. Very cool. I wasn't offended by it, but after I read Mary, I thought, maybe this isn't kind to the actual human being that Marilyn Monroe was.
If you're going to do the problem with when it's taxpayer money that you're going to run into anytime you're trying to make a political statement, like we're going to have a piece of art where there's a politician that has blood on his hands. It's the same thing with like displaying religious ceremonies. And then you're like, you know, at the Capitol and it's like, oh, we have this cross here. Now every religion gets to have, you know, it's equal representation. So that like the Satanists who just want to troll everybody get to have their thing. And it just turns into a mess. So I think it's best to avoid it. The other political message in city funded art that I get so annoyed with is actually it's more just overtly political and it's not meant to be art. It's every time there's like Jazz Fest or anytime there's something that Department of Cultural Affairs is sponsoring, the mayor's name and picture is over everything. We have to bow down to the mayor who's like, oh, thank you, Mr. or Miss Mayor for this culture that I am consuming. And that I hate. Like we should just get rid of that first.
Well, Austin, would you advise the city council to in fact avoid this rather than sending a letter to the mayor? First of all, I would not have maybe known about this were it not for their protests. So if they were so offended by it and they wish people wouldn't be exposed to it, maybe they should have been mum about it. Or maybe that's taking a stance they don't want to. They're saying we're indifferent. We don't care. I know you guys care about it, but maybe you should just shut up about it.
Because it's using city taxpayer money, it's appropriate for them to be responsive to constituent complaints about the use of their taxpayer money. Like, I don't think I can begrudge them that. But I would just encourage them to take kind of a holistic view rather than, that, you know, on how these types of things are funded, maybe rather than just focus on this one thing.
Hamas did start the damn thing. What Hamas did was horrific. Where's the art about that? I don't have an answer to that. But that's the problem. I don't want to ask that question. I don't think it's incumbent on an artist to answer that sort of a question. But
and I think if you had a puppet that was, you know, whatever, it was supposed to be Hamas with blood on its hands, I think you would have members of the city council also talking to the cultural center saying, we're going to take your funding away because of this, which is why I think it's best to probably not wade into these waters.
Yeah, yeah. It's tough, but I think they are going to have to do something with the guidelines. I hate to say there should never be anything political in public art, but you know, there has to be something in between nothing with any political overtone whatsoever and like Ziggy cartoons. There has to be something in there that maybe they could come up with, but it does need to be actually written down in a way that can be followed in a fair manner.
Well, there's something about a statement, you know, if you had a placard that just said, we think that Israel has unfairly bombed Gaza and they have blood on their hands. That's a lot different than the representation in art. And you could ask our friend Scott Stantis about how people react to his cartoons, where he's basically making a statement and people get outraged in a way that they don't get outraged at editorials, because there's something that's very, very blunt and very visceral and very powerful about cartoon art. Art, it's in the Cultural Center, about Picasso's Guernica, things that say things in a way that are much more powerful than the written word. And so people do tend to get outraged by it. I guess the public funding thing maybe argues for not having controversial works of art in public display. It's just said, look, we're going to stay away from
what a loss that would be.
It would be a loss, but that, you know, that I can't think of any other way to sort of say, well, that's a little too strong. I mean, that's you don't want your curators to be in that position, do you?
You know, the wiki on this is 10 pages long on Mirth and Girth, on the one we're talking about. It's 10 pages. And it reminds us that student artist got $95,000 in a lawsuit that was upheld. It went to the U.S. Court of Appeals. Judge Posner wrote
– Posner.
So, Posner, we must ask whether in 1988 the law was clear that local government officials may not go onto private property without the invitation. The aldermen had not been invited to the exhibition of student work, seize a painting that they do not like because it vilifies a public official with whom they have been associated, and wrap it in brown paper and remove it so that no one can see it. To ask the question is pretty much to answer it. As Chief Justice Warren said in another case involving an effort to suppress public criticism of the mayor of Chicago, this is a simple case. You can't do that. But again, that was public officials seizing something on private property. I don't know that it speaks to this. That artist then went on to a career in advertising, as I read this.
I'm reminded of another art controversy where someone had placed an American flag on the floor and you had to step on it to see something else, or he was inviting people to step on it. And I can't remember where that was. I think it was in Chicago, though. And that was, you know, that's just a totally symbolic statement. I'm stepping on the flag, and you can step on a flag accidentally. You can step on a flag unwillingly. But just that very act is much more powerful to people than saying, like, screw America. That's much, much stronger. So art is very
tough. Yeah. And for instance, and I'm pretty sure that the flag on the floor came after what I immediately thought of when I saw this in the paper, which is an episode of the short-lived television series Room 222 when I was a very small child. With Karen Valentine. But the TV was on. I'm watching 222. It's about these cool kids in high school. And do you guys remember the episode where Karen Valentine was teaching adult classes, citizenship classes, and one of her students was outraged when he came to class and saw that her students, she had invited them to do art for open house night about their feelings about the country. And two black students together, put together an exhibit that was a sink with an American flag like over it, but the tip of the flag is going down the drain. And he's the immigrant who was there for citizenship classes was just like out of his mind and destroyed it. And then, of course, came and talked to the class about it later. I'm not sure if they really resolved their differences about it, but he explained, you know, how he had come from some communist. Yeah, they obviously made it like Czechoslovakia or something, right? Because he talked about tanks coming and his family being shot. And that's why the flag meant so much to him. I've remembered it since.
Evidently, what a teachable moment. You learned something
it
there.
It really was.
Wow. Room 222.
It does show you, though, how powerful also this exhibit at the Cultural Center is. It's gigantic. If you see the pictures of it, it is gigantic. So,
the city council is assured that a lot more people are going to see it now than would have otherwise.
That's true. And that's Barbara Streisand effect.
When you ban a book. By the way, speaking of art, let's do our red light, green light, yellow light, red, yellow, green light. This is things we are recommending that you see, recommending that you don't see, or maybe we're somewhere in between. Who wants to go first? Anybody burning with a observation here, a recommendation? I'm like the teacher in room 222. Kate.
Big green light to Severance. The second season finally is here after like 3 or 4 years since the first season. If you've heard anybody talk about it and say that it's like the best show ever made, or they put it like in their top five at least, like maybe it's right behind Breaking Bad and The Wire or whatever, it's true. It really is that good. I think probably any of you guys who have seen it are going to agree with me on that, right? It's absolutely spectacular.
I saw the first season, and I'm curious, first of all, it was a long time ago. Do I need to go back and refresh my memory about
the
season?
Yes.
And the other question is it all streaming at once, or you have to wait every week for a new episode?
Wait every week for a new episode on Friday.
I can't do that. I have to wait.
So you wait like 8 weeks and then you binge it. That's fine.
I will do that.
Oh, that's another idea.
I give you a pass on that.
I did watch the first season, but it was so long ago. I barely remember.
Okay, what's it about? Just give me the thumbnail sketch.
The basic premise is that there's this company named Lumen, which has created this method by which they can insert something in your brain so that you can go to work at Lumen. And when you go down the elevator, you no longer remember like yourself. So your brain creates this whole new personality and person that works downstairs in Lumen and does secret Lumen work and doesn't know your other self and vice versa. And there's a whole incredibly interesting plot line about what they're really doing down there, what's going on with Lumen, as well as the personal stories of the people who have chosen to do this severed procedure and why and the ethics of that. And as serious as it is absolutely hilarious. Wow. So like, Eric, I'm sure if you're not thinking to yourself, oh, darn, I have to rewatch the first season, right? Aren't you thinking, hey, great excuse to rewatch the first season?
What I would like is like a 15 or 20 minute recap of the first season. And I don't like to spend a lot of time rewatching things, but
okay. Yeah, I like to rewatch, but I'm totally sure if you go on YouTube, you can find exactly.
Yeah,
what
I'll
you're
bet somebody's made a reel. Austin, what's your red light, your green light, or your yellow light?
Green. I have two big green lights. One is The Brutalist, which was playing at the Music Box Theater. It's a 3.5 hour movie. There's a 15 minute live intermission in it. It's beautifully acted. The writing's amazing. And the guy made it for $10 million. And it's amazing that he was able to create this huge vision, this massive vision and like huge scope and scale of a project for $10 million. I thought it was really, really good. And then a documentary I watched the next day is called Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat. And it's about the CIA using jazz in the Congolese Revolution in 1960. And it is not only just an insane story that I'd never heard before, but the pacing of the documentary and its style is so good. Slight yellow light because it's slightly too pro-communist throughout the movie. But otherwise, it's like very entertaining, cool documentary.
Good music, I assume.
Great music. Great soundtrack. You got Coltrane, you got Louis Armstrong, you got Art Blakey, Nina Simone. There's all the greats.
I do have a Severance red light, and that is that, and people may have seen this advertised, there's a new Severance podcast that's hosted by Ben Stiller and Adam Scott, Ben Stiller being the director and producer of the series and Adam Scott being the star of it. And it's not worthwhile. Just skip that.
I am going to green light the Michael J. Fox documentary called Still on Apple TV that we watched it last week. Michael J. Fox, of course, has fought Parkinson's disease for like 30 years. And the portrait of him, the courage that he shows in fighting that and the retrospective on his career is fascinating. A very, very well done documentary. Lots of clips from throughout his life. You meet his family, you meet his wife, you meet his kids. Again, I was a little bit apprehensive going into it, but ended up really liking it. I'm going to yellow light, which is caution, the series on Amazon Prime called Jury Duty. Which is the conceit. It's like a huge, elaborate, candid camera episode where they have one guy who has been called for jury duty, or I guess they get him onto a jury, and the whole trial is fake, and all the other jurors are fake, and they set up, you know, like seven or eight episodes of odd things happening and odd characters, and it's I thought it was hilarious. I loved it. I loved watching it, and Johanna, my wife, lost interest after about five, and she suffered through the last few with me. She thought it wasn't that good. So that's why I give it a yellow light, because I respect Johanna's taste a lot, and she didn't get
it. Boy, people whose taste I respect too, love that. I just couldn't get into it. The whole conceit just thought, I'm wasting my time. This is a fake trial, and this poor guy is being exposed for actually being a pretty nice guy. Lucky them, they had him.
There were a lot of little funny things that happened. They enlisted James Marsden, the actor, to be one of the jurors who was called, and he plays himself, and he plays a self-important actor extremely well, and and there are lots of the characters are a lot of funny things happen. So many funny things happen, and the character, the guy Ronald Gladden, who's just the citizen dupe, is such a wonderful guy, and he behaves so mm-hmm. well in all the instances that I just couldn't help but think that some of this was more set up than we thought. Hmm. That it didn't quite ring as true as possible as a candid camera episode, where they would just take a random person mm-hmm. in a very weird situation. But I thought it was very funny. So, any anybody else see it? Any of you, Kate?
Yeah.
Austin?
No, I liked it a lot.
I'm gonna go take a look.
I thought it spoke to the, in a similar way to Eric Andre had a movie that came out around a similar time that's called Road Trip or something with Tiffany Haddish. That's a lot of, it's like somewhat of a prank narrative film. And I think in both cases, they showed like the beauty of average people and like the decency and morality of average people. And Jury Duty, I think like the ending's the best part. I mean, it's like they couldn't, it didn't invite in me the same skepticism as you, but now that you're saying it, I'm like, oh man, how did they pick this one like tremendous guy?
What a score for them
to be in this. Yeah. But I loved it as just like a, just in terms of production design, like there's so much that went into making that, and they like pulled it off yeah. tremendously well.
Did you like Borat then, Austin, too? Did you like that whole scheme?
Borat, I always felt like was punching down too much.
Yeah.
And I think good satire kind of punches up. And Borat was kind of like, when that came out, I was maybe in middle school or something. And no one knew what Kazakhstan was. And that it was a real place. Yeah. And if you're like the minister of like, you know, global affairs for Kazakhstan, you're like, we're screwed for 10 years because this one guy is saying that, you know, we're horrible and backwards. And so I liked, there are parts of Borat that are so like cringe inducing and crazy, and that I'd never seen it in filmed at the time that were good, but I didn't like that it punched it down.
You know, my yellow flag this week is kind of weird. I do have a green one, but the Dave Chappelle monologue on Saturday Night Live, everybody was raving about it, and it went historically long, and they had to bump a tribute that they had planned and all that stuff. So I said, okay, I'm going to watch it a couple days later. But for the last 2 minutes of it, I didn't find myself laughing that much. And I'm such a fan of him. And I'm such a fan of him when he comes on Saturday Night Live just before or after an election. So he is a kind of a go-to voice for, I think, America. I think he's really good at that. He's civil and smart. I was disappointed. The green light for me this week is American Primeval on Netflix, a multi-part series about the Mormons traveling west and establishing their foothold in Utah, and when people would cross through the territory that they felt was theirs, given by the governor or God, they just like kill them. I mean, brutally so. It's brutal, and it's based, as I understand it, on a true story. So you get this whole big picture Yellowstone panoramic. It's really beautiful, but I guess it's true, and if so, doesn't reflect well on the founding fathers of the Mormon Church, the Church of Latter-day Saints. A lot of people have recommended it to me. I'm 3 episodes in. Do we have anything between green and yellow? It's a lot. Wow.
That sounds like a green light still.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
You can revise it. We can revise it in subsequent episodes.
Right. Up till now, I'm still green. Let's go with that.
And I have to say, green light to Dave Chappelle's monologue. If it ended the way I remembered ending, I thought the ending was great.
The last 2 minutes, I thought the first 16, I thought were not as strong.
You didn't like the beginning.
Yeah, and for 18 minutes, I'm like, dude, edit. Chappelle's great. He just went on and on and on.
I get the feeling he was just taking over this. I mean, he came out smoking a cigarette, which you just never see anymore.
He's done that a couple times now, but yeah, I thought it was distracting. He spent so much time working that cigarette, too.
Yeah, it was, and I was thinking that if you just read the words on the paper, it would have really been flat, but he's got his delivery and his affect is really terrific. I was really engaged by it. I really liked it. It's just a change of pace, because often the monologues on SNL are pretty lame, and this one was. I couldn't stop watching it. Certainly, I didn't want to fast forward through it for sure. So.
Yeah, I think the length was a strength, because it didn't feel like a forced, quick monologue. It felt like a real comedy show. It felt like a piece of a real comedy concert.
Yeah, he was patient up there, that's for sure.
He needs that. He needs that for his entire shtick. And didn't you think it was funny when he was talking about the Los Angeles fires? And first he said, oh, it's kind of early to be joking about that. And then he did that big wink. First, he saw friends of his get their homes burned, and on film, he saw people he knew getting chased out of their homes. And then he saw on social media people exulting, like, ah, those celebrities, you know, they deserve what they get. And then he said, you know, that right there, that's why I hate poor people.
Yeah, that was...
They just can't get past their own pain.
Yeah.
I thought it was great.
That's Kay Plies, Eric Zorn, Austin Berg. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. And we'll drop another Green Light podcast on you next week.
That was fun. Thanks, guys.
Oh boy, right. Austin. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, everybody. So long.
See you.
All right. Bye. See ya.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.